Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
You know, this may be a little bit more just the fan side of me, but it's just going to be good to have baseball back, man. It's just going to be good to be back playing. It's going to be good to see Luis Robert running around center field. It's going to be good to see Giolito continue to build. And we're Moncada is growing too. Whether it's 60 games, whatever the schedule looks like, you know, any of that stuff is important from the executive side of me in terms of what it means for the White Sox and how we continue to build to where we want to be on an annual basis. But fundamentally, it's just going to be good to watch some baseball. There's only so many times I can watch that Eloy home run at Wrigley last year and, you know, not wind up thirsty for more.
I don't blame Rick Hahn for being excited about the baseball season getting underway. You think of all the work he's put in and all the difficult seasons leading up to this one. This is where he gets to see the fruits of his labor. White Sox expected to do some big things in 2020. Hi, everyone. Alongside Ron Coomer and Tom Thayer, I'm Zach Zidman. We're in for Mully and Haw to start off this holiday weekend on Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score, broadcasting live from the Hyundai Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. We will talk with Hall of Famer Paul Molitor at 7:30. Then at 8 o'clock, we'll switch gears and talk some football with Doug Williams here on The Score. And before we get to breaking down the 2020 White Sox, and we'll talk about what Coom thinks and Carcion and Grandal and Manzara mean to the lineup. And I'm also going to ask Coom this question. Is Lucas Giolito today the best starting pitcher on the White Sox? It's a big statement because he has been to this point, but there are a lot of youngsters there that are vying for that title as well. But before we get to that, we were on with Peter Gammons last segment, and he was talking about George Steinbrenner, his birthday being on July 4th. And Coom had a wonderful opportunity late in his baseball career to suit up for the Bronx Bombers and has a terrific George Steinbrenner story. And there's a certain point when you realize, at least back when Coom played, that there was Major League Baseball and then there was Major League Baseball for the Yankees. I'll let you take over from there, Coom.
Yeah, well, Tommy, as you know, when you play in a big league season or seasons long enough, there are certain places and certain things that happen when you go, oh, now I understand why we're so successful or why we're bad, right? I mean, one or the other. There's either a missing element there that, you know, you just don't have, or you really have it and you just look around and go, we're going to win and we're going to win every game. I'll never forget leaving the Cubs and being extremely disappointed that I didn't re-sign with the Cubs after the 0-1 season, and just feeling down about that and leaving my hometown. But you know, I was fortunate enough to get a phone call from Joe Torre, and I'd played for him in the All-Star game a couple years prior. And next thing you know, Brian Cashman and I are working out a contract, and you know, I'm a Yankee. So they had just lost the World Series on a little broken bat, base hit up the middle by Luis Gonzalez in Game 7, and the Yankees lost. But they had won 3 out of the last 4 World Series. So you're going to this group that you're thinking, you know, they're the best team in baseball by far. but I didn't understand why. You knew they had great talent, but there's always there's that piece that you don't know until you're with that group. And the Cubs are deal was last to first, right? Our mantra, everything, everybody's talking last to first the year I was with the Cubs. And we almost did it, but we still were a little short. I got to New York at our first day of camp. Joe Torre talks and he's very businesslike and he's talking about the roster and Brian Cashman talks and he's, you know, we have, you know, this group and, you know, there's a couple roster spots and that's it and we're expecting. And Mr. Steinbrenner talks on the first day of camp and it was very simple. His very first statement was this: we expect to win the World Series, boys. And if we don't, this season has been a failure. And there'll be different people in this room next year. And I went, okay, now we know where we stand. We are win or hit the road because you're on a one-year contract. And that's exactly what happened. We went to the playoffs. We didn't win. But I've never been in a professional setting in sport that the owner had such an impact on what was going on. And I mean, he had his fingers in everything. But that first meeting, you could hear a pin drop. And you're talking about the Roger Clemens and Messina and Pettit and Jeter and all these guys in this room, Giambi and Robin Ventura, all of us sitting there and glued to this man that's talking to us. And you're just like, he's as serious as a heart attack, man. There's no BSing with him. It's we win the World Series or it's major disappointment. And that was the first time in my professional career where, you know, you almost hit yourself over the head with your own bat going, hello, this guy wants to win. And I mean, he gave us every opportunity and everything in your power of facilities and things that you would need to win. But Tommy, you almost wish you could have taped that as a business speech going out too, because there was nothing better than Mr. Steinbrenner talking about wanting to win. It was so impactful still to this day in 2020. I get chills thinking about him walking in the room and speaking about winning and what it's going to take for us to win. It was a special moment.
Well, you know what, Coombdog, and it's kind of funny because you talk about going from your hometown team out to New York, and then you kind of felt what New York Yankees were all about, a lot of it through the eyes and the conversation of George Steinbrenner. So a football example that I have. So when I came to the Bears in that rookie class, the Bears had just gotten beat in the NFC Championship game out in San Francisco. So it was a really serious locker room that was pointed in a right direction. So as young guys, we're intimidated, we're nervous, and you know, football is a little different on the how you get dressed and your preparation and everything. And so Jim Morrissey is one of the rookies that came into the rookie class after my time in the USFL. And Jim Morrissey is getting ready for his first Bear game as a Chicago Bear. And he's given jersey number 51, which is – I mean, everybody knows that's Dick Butkus all around the world. So now here's Jim Morrissey, a seventh-round draft choice linebacker out of Michigan State. And he's a young, developing kid. So, I mean, he does have that baby face. So now Jim Morrissey puts his uniform on. He's tucking in his jersey, getting ready. He turns around and look, and here's walking in Dick Butkus.
Oh.
And so it's like, okay, here comes that moment of the realization of what you're really wearing and the legacy behind it. And the worst thing a football player can do at the end of the game is have a really stained backside of your jersey, because you really tells the story of what happened. So Jim Morrissey walks up to Dick Butkus and goes, "How you doing, Mr. Butkus? My name is Jim Morrissey. I'm a linebacker drafted out of Michigan State. And I just want to tell you what an honor it is to wear your jersey and to wear your number." And he goes, "I don't give a crap, kid. Just keep the back of the jersey clean." And then walks away. So it wasn't like a long, intimidating speech of encouragement. It was more of, hey, keep the jersey clean, go out there and play like hell, and the rest will take care of itself. Jim Morrissey went on to have a brilliant career, was really important in his role in development. But, you know, it's the same thing. When I went down to Miami and they gave me my number, they gave me 57. But it came from Dwight Stevenson, a Hall of Fame center. Mm-hmm. So when they gave me 57, I went back to the equipment manager, Bobby Monaco, and I said, hey, did you make a mistake here, or did you want to give me this number? Because this is Dwight Stevenson's number. He's going into the Hall of Fame. And they go, no, this, you know, you're a veteran. This is the number that we want you to wear while you're here. And to me, I looked at it as an honor to have the jersey of such greatness in Dwight Stevenson. However, when I look at a young guy like Jim Morrissey looking into the eyes of Dick Butkus, who you still go eye to eye with, he's a big man, he's thick, and he carries that persona. It was a great transition of the number 51 in the history of the Bears with that.
Talk about that is making an impact on a young guy. Could you imagine that? I'm trying to envision your locker room and Morrissey looking and going, oh, my God, there comes Butkus and I got his jersey on. I'm like, here, you just take it. You go out there and play. I just can't even comprehend that.
Well, you know, you think of Steinbrenner and Butkus. They right. still, you know, years after the fact, they still have such influence inside the locker room and so much effect on the way these guys prepare and want to perform.
Hell, I was not even a football player. I met Dick Butkus once at a charity event. And I was like, should I go say hi to him? You got to go say hi to him. But I'm like, but that's Dick Butkus. You know, you're like, he's like royalty. There's nothing bigger in our city than, like you said, you think the number 51, oh, the best linebacker to ever play the game, Dick Butkus. There you go.
Wait, you know what, Coom? So this past year when we were doing the Bears 100-year celebration, I was on stage with Dick Butkus. And there's a question I always wanted to ask him, but you're never in the atmosphere. And I said, Mr. Butkus, I said, when Sylvester Stallone named his dog Butkus, did he ask your permission before or did it just get written into the script? And he was telling a story how he ran into him recently, or he had ran into him, and Stallone said to him, he goes, hey, in this movie coming out, I named my dog Butkus. And Butkus says, well, do I get any residuals for this? And Stallone goes, no, but he's going to be in the second movie too. So, you know, it's the name Butkus, the number 51, the name Steinbrenner, the name New York Yankees. They're all one because it's hard to say the sentence about each of them without mentioning the record they left behind.
Yeah, incredible. Absolutely.
So we've got more of this for the next 2 hours here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. The Coom Dog Thayer, Zach here for Mully and Haw until 9 o'clock. The Baseball Hall of Famer Paul Molitor will join us at 7:30. Then at 8, we'll talk football with Doug Williams. But until then, let's talk some White Sox baseball. We spent a lot of time talking about the Cubs. Let's talk about the White Sox and what's in store on the South Side this season. And Tom and I, during the break, Coom, were wondering, because he asked me, he goes, is Lucas Giolito the best pitcher on the White Sox? And my answer is yes, based on what he's done in the past. But there are a lot of young guys who are vying for the title of being the best starting pitcher on the White Sox. So when we look at the end of the 2020 season, will Lucas Giolito be the best pitcher or will someone overtake him?
Well, it's a great question. I'll say this. If the White Sox end up a playoff contending team, it'll be Giolito will be their leader in the rotation and bringing him there because they have to have him do really well. Dylan Cease is another guy that to me is that really high upside. You look at him and I just think you've got two young guys that really, you know, have great arms. They have great command of what they're trying to accomplish. But Giolito, to me, stands head and shoulders above everybody else because of the success that he's had already in the league. And there's that, you know, I always say when you get a young guy who's a really talented young guy in our league, in any of the leagues, actually, and they have some real success, and all of a sudden they get that taste, and then they also get kicked down a little bit. I know the Cubs beat up on Giolito a couple times last year, and not terribly, but, you know, I'm sure they were disappointing outings for him playing against the Cubs in your in you know, the crosstown games. You get knocked down just a touch, but you come back and you pitch great again for your team. Those guys that have had some real success and get that taste of it, boy, there's just something about them that they get that edge to them. And I really think Giolito is one of those guys. I looked at him, and he walked off the mound, and he was just steaming when he didn't pitch well against the Cubs. And I always look at that character thing that you can't drag. You look at and you can't put a number on. There's that inside a person's soul when they're playing and they're playing a game hard and it doesn't work out. What do you see from that guy? Because everybody can be fired up when you're doing great. But it's what's going to happen to that guy when he gets beat up a little bit and how is he going to respond? And I thought Giolito, you know, the look in his eye was just disgust and upset and just, I like that. I like seeing my guys, you know, have that grit to them. And I think he's one of them. And I expect him to, if he can stay healthy, to have a really big year for the White Sox. I really do.
Coom, I think it was last year I was watching a Sox game. Maybe it was the year, I think it was last year. But Steve Stone did a great description of how Giolito changed his throwing motion while he shortened it up in it, from the mound. Is it easy not to revert back to the way you used to do things to keep him in the way that you're doing things now that increase your success rate? Or is it a full-time concentration of making sure that you stay within this motion that they shortened up to create the success that he's had?
Well, Tommy, early when you make a change, like any sport, especially that's something that's so much muscle memory, to make a change in your arm action or your swing as a hitter and make a major change like Giolito did, it's almost daily work, right? It's playing catch and making sure you're doing the same thing every time with that change involved. It's throwing your bullpens and doing the same thing and then looking at the film of you throwing your bullpens and then looking at your game film. I really believe for him, he shortened his arm action, and then what it made him able to do is repeat the arm action, right? It was easier to step and repeat than it was having that really long arm action that he had before. So when you look at a guy that is willing to make that change, first of all, that's not easy to convince a young guy because they really haven't had a lot of failure yet. And then to do it and then succeed at it, it was impressive. And then you put his competitiveness into that pitcher too. He made some major changes, and they're not easy changes to make at the highest level of your game.
You know, Jose Abreu has called Edwin Encarnacion the missing piece to the White Sox. Now, why do you think he's saying that when you look at all the pieces they now have in the outfield?
Well, when you look at their team, you've got an all-star first baseman. You've got, you know, a second baseman that could be, maybe. The shortstop, you know, he's an all-star and the batting champion, but a very young player. Second base, very young. You know, third base, same thing. Moncada's another really young player. But then when you add somebody like the catcher, in Grandal, and then in Encarnacion, he's a guy that understands the league and understands the roles of different players, and then also has that intangible of winning and knowing what it takes to win, and has had a lot of success for a long time. You know, he's going to make a major impact on some of these young kids in how they hit, and in particular at that ballpark, because, you know, when you go to the south side of the city, that ballpark plays extremely small in the middle of summer. And to have a guy like Edwin, who knows how to swing the bat, knows how to drive the baseball, and he's going to teach some of these young kids the how and when to really take your shots at changing the game with a home run. Even though that's such a big part of the game now, you know, to play winning baseball, there's multiple aspects of how you play offensively if you're a really good team. And he's got all of it. He really does. And, you know, you talk about an impact bat. He's going to be an impact bat and really be protection for some of those young hitters.
Yeah, think about that outfield with Jimenez and Robert and now Nomar Mazara added to the mix. I mean, there's the potential there for that to be the best slugging outfield in the American League.
Well, and Robert is one of those guys, we haven't seen him a lot, but everybody that I've talked to just raves about all of his skills. So, you know, that's one of those things that you go, boy, if a couple of these guys can get to him and really teach him, you know, the intricacies of how he can be successful at home plate. You've got a couple of them, and Anderson, Jimenez, and now Robert. That's pretty good.
Got to take a timeout. When we come back, one of the best players in the history of Major League Baseball, and he's also a good friend of Ron Coomer's, the Hall of Famer, Paul Molitor, joins us next. Tom Thayer is here. I'm Zach Zaidman. The Coom Dog is along. We're in for Mully and Haw on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Dan Jackson has retired 8 in a row since the triple by Molitor. That's well hit to left. In Cavilla watches it go. Home run, Paul Molitor. So playing first base agrees with Molitor. A two-run triple in the first. And a line solo home run here in the third.
Gene Tinnis, the hitting instructor of the Blue Jays, says that Molitor's hips explode on the ball. And you could see right there, Paul Wehner, Little Poison, used to say you have to belly button the ball. And did Molitor ever belly button that inside slider from Danny Jackson?
Did a lot more than that over the course of his career. Seven-time All-Star, World Series champion, World Series MVP, four-time Silver Slugger, American League Manager of the Year, and Baseball Hall of Famer. Joining us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park, is Paul Molitor. I'm Zach Zaidman. Tom Thayer is along, and so is Ron Coomer. Paul, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Score. And before we get to all the great things that you've done, I want your best Ron Coomer story.
Oh, God.
Well, first of all, good morning to you guys. Happy 4th of July weekend.
Good morning, Polly. You
know, hey, Coom. I was fortunate, Zach, to have the chance to play with Coom when he came up here to the Twins. And, you know, I know that the morning drive time hour is a little bit more friendly than maybe some of the hours, other hours of the day, but I don't know if I can go down the road of how many stories I could tell about the Coom Dog. So, but I will tell you one thing. We had a heck of a lot of fun playing the game together. And, man, you talk about a guy who put his work in to finally get his due at the big league level. And we might not have had a best years as a team together, but we sure we had fun and we took a lot of pride in teaching the young guys how to play the game right.
Well, we had a lot of fun, there's no doubt, Paulie. And you know, the other thing too is Tommy and I and Zach were talking earlier about the NBA, and I don't want to spend too much time because there's a lot to talk about with you and what's going on now in your career in the past.
Sure.
But there's a certain thing when you're playing, like this NBA group is going to have a deal here in Chicago, and they're going to play, and it's the eight teams that aren't making the playoffs. But there's a lot to play for these young players, and a pride factor, and getting them, you know, their toehold in the league. I just don't think people understand that enough of how and why you play the sport that you do. And even if they can't play for a championship, they're still playing for a lot, even though they're not going to win a championship this year.
Yeah, I think those are really good points, Ron. You know, obviously with the different formats the various leagues have come up with to try to squeeze in a season here, you know, in some strange months for those sports to be witnessed by us as fans, these guys do have a lot on the line. And we know most of the people play the game at a professional level because they still have the passion, obviously very talented. But you do have to at some point make your mark to where you can, you know, kind of become somewhat established and begin to predict your future a little bit better. And despite these teams not having a chance to advance to any, you know, through rounds as far as potential champion, it's very significant for these guys to get themselves established if they can. You know, we see it in baseball every year where guys come up in September and maybe they're prospects and they're looking to make their mark and hopefully set a good tone for their opportunities to contribute in the years to come.
Paulie, I got a question for you. Tom Thayer played on the Bears Super Bowl championship team, and he asked me a great question about how do you coach. So the Cubs are going through this period where they're trying to incorporate better base running. They had some lapse in base running skills last year, and it didn't work out as well. And coaching base running.
Yes.
From the day you stepped on the field in the Metrodome, you were the best base runner at 38 years old, I think you were when you signed, or 39, I think you were when you signed with the Twins. You were the best base runner in the league, and everybody knew it. Javi Baez could be known as one of the best base runners in the league. But how do you coach that? What do you do to kind of, I mean, you were that, and then you sure managed, and now David Ross has this task of, what do you do with a guy like Javi? Do you cut him loose? Do you talk to him about it? What do you do with a guy like Javi, who's maybe one of the most exciting players in the game?
Well, it's a subject that has to do with the game that I really think is undervalued, even in the era of home runs and, you know, the people sitting back and trying to see how many times they can hit over the park. And I also want to say it's a pleasure to be on with Tom. I certainly appreciate and respect his great career that he had for the Bears. But, you know what, some interesting conversations along the way that I've heard. I remember Tom Kelly, who managed two Twins World Series teams, talking with people like Joe Torre and Tony La Russa, and there was kind of a consensus that in a long season, 162 games, your starting pitching is probably going to be the most important variable that allows you to attain your goals. But they were a lot of discussion about how base running might be the second biggest element over the course of a long season, just because of the fact of taking advantage of opportunities, maximizing your ability to score runs and take advantage of moving up 90 feet when you can. And for me to teach it, it was challenging because, you know, as a player, you want to hit and maybe make a great play, but you don't think about making the instinctive, intuitive base running decision that could be a differential in a game. But, you know, I always tell people speed is not a requirement to be a good base runner. I've seen so many guys with average or maybe even below average speed that always seem to make the right decision. And, you know, to kind of capsize it to them, you really have to get these guys to buy in that, you know, their job isn't just to get on base. Your job continues until you cross home plate. And that means being able to include as many extenuating circumstances around that particular juncture of the game and try to process that stuff in your brain as best as you can so when the ball's put in play, you can make a good decision on what you need to do. Obviously, the obvious things are the scoreboard, the inning, the score, the outs, and all those type of things. But it goes a lot deeper. And the more of those things you can include in your decision process, the better base runner you're going to be.
Hey, Paul, this is Tom Thayer. It's an honor to talk to you, and I'm excited to get a chance to ask you a couple of questions. Throughout my time in football, Paul, I never liked inter-squad games because I didn't like playing against my own teammates. So then when I see him talk about the restart of baseball and having some inter-squad games, is that helpful to a team or – I mean, is it okay for Javi to bat against John Lester, or because you're more familiar with them? How did you feel about inner squad games in preparation?
Well, you know, back to Coombs' last question, you know, Javi is a great base runner, and I would turn him loose for the most part. You got to trust he's going to make decisions, whether it's a one-run game in the ninth or setting him free in the first inning. But as far as the inner squads, I thought they were a little bit of a necessary evil to preparation for a season. With spring training getting stretched out, they became less of a factor because they play so many games scheduled down there, either in Florida or Arizona throughout the course of a spring training. But, you know, you can run into problems because you want the guys to play the game right when you have inner squad games, but you also don't want to hurt your teammates. We had an incident in spring training with the Twins back in Fort Myers, you know, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, where our major league team played our AAA team the last day of spring training, and one of the AAA guys hurt our second baseman on a slide on a double play. And, you know, a lot of people were very upset that this guy went into second base hard in an inter-squad game, and I kind of tended to go with the player that he didn't do anything that was, you know, outside the boundaries of what a good hard slide was, and he was somewhat reprimanded for that. So you can run into some strange situations that cause angst among teammates, and you got to be a little careful. And I think when it best suits yourselves, try to avoid those type of games if you can.
So one question you have to have put on both hats as a player and a manager. The Houston Astros, do we hit them or forgive them as a player? As a manager, Houston Astros, do we hit them or forgive them on the manager side of it?
Paul, you want me to say where I stand?
Sure.
Nutball.
Oh, wow.
Could you imagine that happening 25 years ago and nothing happening?
No, I'm sure that even if some clubs are going to decide to just play the game and hopefully beat them on the scoreboard, I can't imagine there's not enough pitchers, maybe even some that still recall games against the Astros back in the year where they were caught for what they did and it cost them either personal wins or stats or whatever. It's going to be tough to help rein those guys in, and I'd be surprised if we don't see some retaliation along the way, even though it's only going to be 60 games.
Could you imagine being a Dodger and having to play the Astros and knowing that, I know I wouldn't be able to control myself, but you know, that's been a problem for me for years. So that's okay.
It could get ugly early. You know what I mean? They're going to have enough trouble keeping rosters together with the pandemic, I believe. And this is going to possibly throw another wrench into that equation.
Yeah, you get the feeling that if we weren't dealing with a pandemic, there would be no doubt as to how this thing would play out. But the fact that there is the virus that we're dealing with, maybe it gives people a little bit of second thought. And the other weird dynamic, Paul, is because of the climate that we're in, you know, the Astros are going to be playing the Dodgers a whole lot this season compared to the way things normally would be. So I think that's the added dimension to all of this that we haven't spent a lot of time talking about.
Yeah, some of the matchups that have been determined by how they're going to stay within their division, even if it's the opposing league, is going to cause some stir, especially that Dodger-Astro matchup, I think, coming out of the gate. So we'll see how it unfolds. But, you know, there's going to be some you're going to have to approach it very carefully because of the fact that with 60 games, you know, these things are all going to be magnified. You know, we all can preface our comments by saying, you know, let's hope and pray that these games do get off the ground and, you know, we're able to see some semblance of major league pitching with full rosters and all those type of things. But you have to be careful. You know, teams that start out 3-7, man, their mountain got a lot higher than when you look at a club like the Nationals being 12 or 13 games under 500 after 45 or 50 games last year. It's going to be tough to dig yourself out of a hole with such a shortened schedule.
Paulie, on the serious side of just looking at our game, there's something that you did that was unique that the Cubs are going to experience this year. You managed, took over the job as the manager of the Minnesota Twins, and had never managed before in the minor leagues. You coached in the big leagues, but had never managed in the big leagues. The Cubs this year, with this pandemic and all the differences that our game is going to experience this year. David Ross is going to manage for the first time in the big leagues and not manage in the minor leagues. When you look at this season and compare it to maybe what you had to go through a few years back when you took over the manager's job, what do you think about David and some of the things that he's going to have to deal with this season?
Well, I'm really happy for him. He seems that he's very deserving of an opportunity to lead a team and stepping into that Cubs role with Joe heading out west. It's going to present its challenges. I think that he's been groomed tremendously well, considering he hasn't managed in the minor leagues or at any other level, you know, as a catcher, and how he sees the game and just what we know about him and his leadership qualities. I think it'll go fairly smoothly. But I would imagine for any manager heading into an unknown of a shorter schedule, some of the new rule implementations are going to all cause, you know, various degrees of challenge for these guys that are running these clubs. But I know he's got great a reputation, and a lot of these guys know him. They were teammates. He has the benefit of having that time down in Arizona before the game was shut down, which I think will be helpful. But, you know, you get out there in the heat of the battle and it's your first time around, man, things get sped up. You know, whether you're a player or a coach or manager, your ability to slow down the game is hugely important in making good decisions. And hopefully he can rely on some of those experiences as a player and get himself and his team off to a good start.
Hey, Paul, with some of the rule changes that you talked about, either the DH in the National League or the relief pitchers having to face three batters, would that change the way you went about business, considering, okay, I have a relief pitcher that I know is good for nine pitches, or is it a process of making sure that you can develop a mentality within these guys that they have to have that belief that they're going in for three and not coming out until?
I think part of it is going to be able to establish the, you know, how these pitchers mentally prepare for their outings. You know, we've had a lot of guys that have kind of, you know, moved into roles of just facing that one hitter, that lefty on lefty matchup or whatever the case might be. And I think that's why you saw even last winter some clubs really breaking down the analytics of certain guys and looking at the left-right splits and see who could maybe fit with this new format. I just hope it goes off without a hitch in terms of teams trying to find a way to manipulate around the rule. You know, you got a left-right, left combination coming up, and you got an open base. So, you know, you drill a guy to get to the next guy, and he's one of your batters or whatever the case might be. I think it's going to be a challenge for managers, a challenge for some of these pitchers who haven't had to face more than one or two guys. But, you know, the commissioner and the league has decided that's the way they want to go to try to at least contribute to the fact that they want to make these games improve in terms of pace and time of game played.
Hall of Famer Paul Molitor is our guest here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. Paul, when you managed, what was your philosophy on incorporating analytics with the way you used to play the game back in the day?
Sure.
How do you mesh those two things together in order to maximize the kind of baseball you'd like to see?
Well, you know, without getting too long-winded, I appreciate that question. Naturally, when I finished playing, it was a long time ago now, and it was just kind of a gradual influx of information over the past couple of decades that has really grown exponentially over the past handful of years, especially when I was managing for those 4 years as the Twins. And I think anybody that wants to do their job as well as possible in that role, they have to be willing to say, hey, this information has its place in the game. I think that we might have went overboard a little bit as people started to make almost all the decisions solely on analytics. You have to remember that you're still dealing with people and players, and hopefully you know your guys as well as anybody and how they react to situations. But I think for the most part it's been good. I think that we'll see a little bit of a trend, you know, as we go forward here, where we're going to start balancing out how those two factors, analytics and the players involved, and hopefully guys still can make decisions and not use the scapegoat of this is what the analytics told me to do, because that's not always going to be the right decision.
Paulie, Tommy asked you a question, you know, when we were talking about managing and then also the DH and changes of rules. The Cubs got a unique situation too. So, right, they got Kyle Schwarber, who kind of fits the role of the DH, but but has turned himself into a good left fielder and a guy that can really throw the baseball, which is unique now in our game.
Yep.
But nobody has probably made the transition better than you from going as an all-star caliber defensive player to, because of some injuries, you going into the DH role and then taking that DH role and turning it into this thing where you impacted the game not only with your bat but with your ability to run the bases and your speed and just being able to also, you know, for me, being a coach on the bench of seeing the game through your eyes and being able to run things sure. past you as a player. What do you see for the National League guys, in particular a guy like Kyle Schwarber, who's going to DH probably more than he ever has, for sure.
Right.
But that role, that's going to be a very different situation for a guy who's been out in the field all the time and now may DH, 30, 40, 50% of his games.
Sure. Well, there's different ways to approach the DH role, and guys that haven't done a lot usually seek counsel on what might best suit their, you know, personality and makeup and how they get themselves mentally through a game. You know, I see guys sometimes that are DH, and you never see them take their batting gloves off. They're in the cage every inning if they're not getting an at-bat in that particular inning. And then the other extreme is guys that, you know, have the ability to, you know, take their at-bat. They prepare for it the half inning before they know they're going to get a chance, whether it's stretch their legs, take a couple of swings. But they focus more on just staying with the flow of the game mentally, you know, whether it's watching or helping their teammates. And then naturally, as their spot in the lineup starts to get closer, they start preparing for their at-bat and whatever the circumstances might dictate. But, you've got to have a little bit of trial and error. I find that guys that first start all that in that role are either really hot or really cold, because you have that 40, 50 minutes sometimes in between at-bats where you're thinking about your previous at-bat or who you might face, and you can kind of get a little bit paralyzed by trying to overthink what happened and might happen in your next at-bat. So, for me, the best thing to do was stay in the flow of the game, not worry so much about my mechanics and what I was doing, because it can – like I said, it can be tough to just dwell on those things and try to just be ready for whatever that circumstance might bring.
Paul, mechanics. Did you ever think of mechanics? You had the Terry Steinbach and I would hit in Molly's hitting group, guys, and we would call him the freak. He had the shortest, quietest swing on the planet. And I mean on the planet. And Steiny and I would always we'd talk in the cage and we'd be like, there's no way you could teach what he does in your swing. You had this, you had almost virtually no movement at all, and you're hitting a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, and you had the quickest swing in the game. And we just went, well, if we had to do that, we would have never got out of high school baseball. And it was amazing, absolutely amazing what you could do at home plate with your approach to hitting. It was so unique.
Well, you know, I do think you see some people that have kind of trended that way, especially with two strikes, you know, trying to find a way to put the ball in play, especially when you got runners out there, you're trying to move second or third or score from third. And to be honest, Coom, I had a stride and more of a load and all those types of things as a younger player. And over time, you know, you just kind of evolved to try to give yourself the best chance to make consistent contact. So, I worked at it. I got tired of chasing sliders in the dirt and split balls, split fingers and all that. And I just figured out I had to find a way to see the ball a little bit longer. And what I could do to make that happen involved kind of cutting down on some of the movement and those type of things, and trusting that you could recognize a pitch before you committed to what you were going to try to do with it.
Hey, Paul, what fundamentals will you be paying attention to within the first 2 weeks of the game? Because, you know, field and batting, or – Is it aggressive base running to make sure that you keep your legs healthy and don't become susceptible to some type of pull that you're not prepared for early?
Well, this whole thing is going to create challenges. I mean, you know, players subconsciously are going to know they have 3 weeks to get ready. Are they going to overdo it as far as how quickly they push themselves? You know, Coom knows that. You know, when you have 6 weeks in spring training, it takes some of the pressure off, and now that's all going to be elevated. And then you get into the start of the season, and everybody knows that with 60 games, your margin of error isn't very, very large. So there's going to be a really concentrated effort on trying to play the game as cleanly as possible. But I still think you have freedom to go out. You need to have freedom to go out there and try to execute and play. I think how managers handle their pitching staffs, run scoring opportunities, all those things. I got a feeling we might see a little bit of unpolished baseball as we get started here later this month. Some of the things defensively and maybe pitchers' ability to ramp up to a heightened situation late in the games right away, just because of the time to prepare is going to be so much shorter than what they're normally accustomed to. It'll be part of the manager's job to evaluate who's been doing what before they got back together. For a lot of teams, that means today, and try to gauge that as they go through these next 3 weeks to prepare to play.
All right, now we're going to put you on the hot seat here, our final few moments here with Baseball Hall of Famer Paul Molitor. Give me your take on what you expect to see from the 2020 Vikings.
Hey, man, I have to tell you, growing up here in the Twin Cities, that team's been a part of my life for, the majority of my 60-plus years. So I follow. I'm wishing them well. There's debate up here even with Cousins signing the extension, how that's going to play out. Delvin Cook is going to be a huge part of that team's ability to compete offensively. We've kind of gone to the throwing league a lot more than running league, but he's one of those backs that can change how you play the game offensively in your game planning. But hoping for the best, man. It's going to be let's hope when we get to fall that we can actually watch some NFL football, because between that and the college game, it's the odds I still think are stacked up against them a little bit, but hopefully they figure out and how they can get it done.
Well, Paul,
man, I hope you're right.
Yeah, I do too. I really hope you're right for all of us, for the baseball season to get off and not have the pandemic, stop our season, and then also, sure, football and the fall sports and going into winter. We need to get this virus controlled, obviously. But, Paulie, we never talked this early in the morning. Even during spring training, we were barely getting in, unless we're on a golf cart. Now, that would be the only reason. So yeah. I appreciate you getting up this early, and we're not hitting that little white ball, having a cup of coffee in a golf cart, buddy. Always great to talk to you. Miss seeing you. But hopefully we have a season soon, bud.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Nice to be on with all three of you guys. It's already like 85 degrees here this morning, so I had no problem getting up and getting rousted. But, let's keep our fingers crossed that we have some live sports to watch moving forward. You guys stay well, stay healthy, and enjoy the fourth, as I said in the beginning.
Yeah, have a great holiday weekend. Paul Molitor, the Baseball Hall of Famer, spending some time with us. I'm Zach Zaidman. Ron Coomer's along. So is Tom Thayer. Let's take a break. When we come back on the Mully and Haw Show, we will visit with Doug Williams. A lot of football conversation on the docket next on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.